Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based wrestling program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guests. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. This is a special edition with our guest, Brian Alvarez. Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I am your host, DJ Impact, and I have some of the bad boys with me, as others are always on assignment. Sin City Steve, you're here. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. And we have Matt Michaels. Welcome.
What's going on? I'm very excited about our guest, Matt.
Are you?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'm excited too, man. Let me just do a little bit of a brief introduction. This guy, we know he's wrestled some. He did a little Brazilian jiu-jitsu. He co-wrote a book titled The Death of WCW. He started a podcast before the term podcast was termed podcast. You can watch it weekly. Titled The Wrestler Observer, Figure 4, Vegas Bad Boys. Welcome, Brian Alvarez.
What? Oh, man. Listen to that. Wow.
Yeah, we got a whole studio audience in today.
We do.
Excellent.
Awesome.
So, Brian, my first question for you is very simple. How does one get their grandmother onto a podcast?
Well, first you have to have a podcast. I mean, I guess that's number one. And I barely had one when she first came on. There was a book about the Fabulous Moolah,
right,
that I got in the mail, and I didn't really want to read it. And I think it was over her house. I don't even remember really how it happened, but she offered to read the book and then write a book report for the newsletter, if I recall correctly. And I was like, okay, if you want to. I mean, I don't think you've ever done a book report in your life. She only went to eighth grade, so
wow.
I don't know what kind of book report she was doing, but she read the book. She wrote a book report, which was like one paragraph. It's like the shortest book report in history. And I think we were like, you should come on the show and just like read your book report. And she came on and she read the book report, and all of a sudden everybody thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so we have had her on every single week for, God, what is it now? 12 years, I think.
Wow.
It's got to be 12, 13 years or so.
Nice.
She's 89 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Brian, I can definitely tell you, I am a subscriber to The Observer and to Figure Four, and I love the episodes when, you know, it's the Brian and Vinny show with Granny. It's probably the highlight of my week, I shit you not.
It's weird because when she first started doing it, she would have been about 75 or 76.
Wow.
And, I mean, that was still pretty old at the time.
Right.
But, you know, every year you kind of think, well, how long is she going to be doing this for? And I could never have imagined that she would still be doing this when she was 89. And not only still doing it, but, like, she has got, I mean, her brain, if you're looking at, like, on a scale of 1 to 100, I mean, it's still at 100.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she has no, like, no signs of dementia, anything like that. I mean, she remembers way more than Vinny does, and, you know, 43 years old. So it's pretty amazing. She's really on top of her game and still doing it.
That's awesome, man. And so, obviously, speaking about books, as was mentioned, the Death of WCW was a great read as well. As far as the book itself, was that as successful as you thought that it would be, as far as, you know, in terms of the income, not necessarily the income, but the readership, I should say, of that book?
It's been more successful than I ever would have even imagined. I mean, Artie Reynolds, who had written WrestleCrap, approached me about doing it. And, you know, this was 2004, so So like the only wrestling books that were successful were the ones that, you know, The Rock or Mick Foley or, you know, whoever. The big time WWE stars from the Attitude Era wrote books, and they made the New York Times bestseller list. And there were like almost no other wrestling books. And the non-WWE wrestling books, I mean, you know, I don't know how they sold, but, you know, probably a few thousand copies or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, I figured it would, I'd always wanted to write a book, and I knew it wouldn't be a bad book, mm-hmm. but I didn't think there was like any chance of it being on the New York Times bestseller list or selling tens of thousands of copies or anything like that. But for whatever reason, I mean, it was like a, I mean, I know it's me saying this, but like you can, if you don't believe me, you can ask ECW Press. It was a gigantic, outstanding success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had them tell me, you know, they've told me what normal books do, like normal non-WWE wrestling books, and we, like, blew past all of those.
Wow.
And, I mean, it's 2019 now. The book first came out in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking 15 years this book has been not only in print,
mm-hmm.
but it still sells, like, thousands of copies every year.
And
I think we're at 85,000 copies now. I just
wow.
got the report a week ago. And, you know, every year I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, we have to have popped out. And then every year I get the statement and I'm like, we sold how many copies this year? I mean, I think the numbers this year were, see if I can do the math. It's not going to turn out well. But, I mean, we probably sold 6,000 or 7,000 copies.
Wow.
In 2018.
Wow.
You know, the book first came out in 2004. So it doesn't make any sense, but I'm certainly happy about it.
Well,
but I never would have imagined it would have done this well.
And it's really cool. I mean, most wrestling books in general, you know, like you said, don't really get the sell unless it's a, you know, a WWE pushed book or something like that. But you guys actually got a 10th anniversary edition put out. That's how popular the book was. It's crazy.
Yeah, they asked us if we wanted to do a 10th anniversary, and I mean the main reason I did it. There were two reasons I did it. The main reason was the original. We had to cut out so much, and I mean for the 10th anniversary edition, I mean we literally a lot of it was just putting stuff back in that had been
nice.
Cut out of the original, because you know the original again it was 2004, and there was no history of wrestling books outside of WWE selling, so they were like. Dude, 100,000 words, that's 20,000 more than we wanted. And so, you know, you can imagine how much I cut out the history of WCW. And so we put 40% more back in, and we added some things, and we did an epilogue, and we changed some things that turned out to not be factual. And I mean, it's a much better book now.
Yeah.
But it, you know, I wanted to do it to pull back what I took out originally, and I wanted a hard copy. And those were literally the two reasons that I did it.
Nice.
Very cool. And now, obviously, you have another book in the works currently. If you could just kind of run that down for us.
Very quickly, it's just 100 Things WWE Fans Should Never Do Before They Die. Triumph Books has a series. They have all sorts of 100 Things books, like 100 Things, Pearl Jam Fans Should Never Do Before They Die, whatever. So they wanted to do a WWE one. And, I mean, it's already done. I mean, I've already got a copy of the book. They just got back from the printer about a week ago.
Oh, nice.
And they'll be in bookstores July 16th. Bookstores,
nice.
Amazon, everything like that. And it's basically 100 things every WWE fan should know or do before they die. It's like 100 entries in order. But it's really kind of like a history of WWE. Like, literally everything that you would want to know about WWE. All the way down to, like, the first Crown Jewel show that was a disaster. I mean, it's all in there. So if you're a WWE fan, like, it's the book for you. There's a WCW book, and now there's a WWE book.
Perfect.
Well, you know, along those lines, you know, I think one of the things that helps is that you have had the in-ring experience. I think that a lot of times... You know, people who go into this and pursue this don't really understand the perspective of what it takes to be in the ring. And you and I are the same age. We were born in the same year. I pursued wrestling for a little bit as a hobby, early 2000 at UPW. And I would never trade that experience. What was it for you getting into the training and into the business as an actual wrestler that was the most fulfilling part of doing that before you transitioned out of it?
Well, I mean, I loved wrestling from when I was 12 or 13 years old. And, you know, within a year, I was like, I want to do this. And, you know, this was 1993. And, you know, there was no... Actually, this was even earlier than that. This was like 91, 92.
Okay.
And, you know, nowadays, you just find a school, you go train, and you're off.
Right.
But it wasn't like that back then. And So there was, like, no opportunity for, you know, 14, 15-year-old kid to get into wrestling. So my friends and I did gymnastics, and we just did pro wrestling at the gymnastics facility. And we didn't have a ring, but we had, like, a spring floor. So we just didn't have ropes and everything like that. But, I mean, we ran shows. We had a 30-minute show every week on Seattle Public Access. I mean, we had our own promotion in 1994, 1995.
Man.
And, you know, I mean, I haven't been doing it nonstop, obviously. Like, I've taken years off, actually.
Right.
But I started doing it 25 years ago. And that actually morphed into the newsletter. And then, you know, by 1998, it was a little easier to get in, so I found a promotion to be the Ross and the Midget, the Wrestler, and the rest is history. But, you know, I think, I don't know, I don't know if there's a most fulfilling part. I think I always wanted to do it, but I knew that I didn't want to be like a WWF, WCW guy, because I knew, I'd known enough about wrestling to know that, number one, I was too small, especially during that era.
Right.
And also, it was just a horrible life to live.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I really enjoyed being able to do it, and I had a lot of fun doing it, and I still have fun doing it today. So,
yeah.
At 44 years old, I mean, I do a show, and I do the travel, like, for just one show a weekend, and it's like, dude, this is brutal. It's a horrible, brutal life. I can do it once a month, but I don't understand how people can do this, like, 4 days a week for WWE or you know, it's just, it's brutal. But I love doing it and being able to do it, and I think I did it at a decent level. I certainly wasn't, like, the best wrestler in the world or anything like that, but I didn't suck, and so I was happy with that.
Sure. And you actually, now it makes a lot more sense for you not to be doing that because you've got a child and a second kid on the way, is that correct?
I do have a 3-year-old and another one that's due in September.
Wow.
And that's another good reason to do a very limited number of dates.
And how is it being a father and yet you're a sports journalist for something that is 24/7, 365 days a year?
Well, I mean, the good thing is right now she is not even in preschool yet, and so I do Observer Live from noon to 1, but I have a fair amount of time during the day where I can go and hang out with her and my wife, and the real work usually starts in the evening. I'm usually up till, you know, 2 or 2:30 a.m., and all of the shows I have to watch are in the evening, so I usually do, like, the vast majority of my work after she goes to bed. Mm-hmm. I mean, she usually is getting ready for bed at 6:30. So I can work nonstop from then until, you know, 2:30 a.m. or whatever, and then I do my stuff in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got little activities she does in the morning, so I can work in the morning while she's doing her activities, and then I usually get from, like, 1 to 4, 1 to 5, somewhere around there to play with her.
Yeah.
So I do get a lot of time in there, and we do a lot of fun stuff, and I can kind of work around her schedule. So yeah, it's. I mean, it was very hard when she was first born, obviously, because you also don't get any sleep on top of everything else.
Right. Exactly.
And so I'm kind of preparing myself for this new one being born, because I'm gonna have at least 4 to 6 months of no sleep on top of everything else.
That is true.
So that'll be brutal, but yeah. It's fun.
Yeah. Definitely.
She knows nothing about wrestling, and she never will, hopefully.
I don't know if you can keep her away from that, man.
I'm trying.
So obviously, Brian, you know, the thing that a lot of people know you for is kind of, you know, the joint venture with yourself and obviously Dave Meltzer. How did that partnership come about?
I mean, really came about in the 90s when I had a 1-900 hotline, the old call the wrestling hotline, $1.99 a minute. And long story short, it went out of business. The 900, you'll notice there aren't 900 lines anymore.
Yeah.
They were, long story short, like if you had a kid, if my kid called the 900 line in the 90s, and, you know, she ran up a $25 phone bill or whatever. I mean, I could call the company and say, I didn't authorize this. I'm not going to pay. And the phone company would say, okay. And the provider would be forced to pay back that money. And the key was, let's say that it was $2 a minute, and I got 80 cents of that.
Yeah.
If somebody rang up the bill and didn't pay it, I had to pay the whole $2 back. Not just my 80 cents. I had to pay the whole
$2. Oh, wow. Damn.
So this happened, and I ended up owing like $4,000, something like that, that I didn't have. So I shut it down.
Yeah.
And I called. I sent Dave a fax because he had a 900 line. And I said, would you like somebody to work on your line? Mine shut down. And he goes, sure. So that's how I first met him and started. And then a couple of years later, the IATA online radio station in New York kicked off. Bob Meyerowitz of UFC ended up starting that up. And Dave was a host of the wrestling show, and he wanted a co-host, and that ended up being me. And literally the rest is history. We've been working together ever since.
That's awesome. The two of you have developed an amazing chemistry. Just from listening to the audio, it never ceases to amaze me. Just the number of tangents that Dave can go off on. You know, he'll go off on 10-minute tangents off topic, and typically those audios are being recorded at about 2 a.m. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Because obviously, I mean, the rumor is that you know, Dave doesn't sleep. So
Dave does sleep.
Ah.
And I can tell you, I'll fill you in on something here. I don't know if I've ever told this story before.
Okay.
Publicly.
All right.
But it is rare. I could probably count on about one hand how many times this has happened. But there have been times where Dave is so tired that he falls asleep during the mailbag. And so what will happen is I will ask him a question. Like, for example, I'll say, this person here wants to know what was the buy rate for the first UFC. And Dave will start answering the question. And in the middle of the question, he will start talking about something completely unrelated.
Right.
And it's not going off on a tangent. He'll be like, well, the amazing thing about the first UFC is they had no TV. And despite having no TV, the first show did 190,000 buys, which, I mean, the cable companies were stunned by that. And as a result, AEW got a deal that was worth X number of money. And like, that's when I know I got to wrap up the mailbag.
Yeah. So
when he's done answering the question, I'll wrap up the mailbag, and then I'll go back and I'll edit that one out. And I'll just go right to the end because I don't want people to think that Dave is losing his mind.
Right.
But that has happened on at least three or four occasions. So I can confirm that he's fallen asleep. And I also know he falls asleep because there was a time where he came over to my house and we were going to do a show. And I was like, Dave, we got to do the show. It's 1 o'clock. And he goes, we got to watch SmackDown first. And I was like, no, we don't have to watch SmackDown. Let's just do this show. No, we got to watch SmackDown. So we go down and watch SmackDown, and he fell asleep 15 minutes in.
Oh, jeez. Gotcha.
So, yeah, I can confirm he sleeps.
Is most of the recording...
But he doesn't sleep a lot.
Ah.
Does most of the recording you do is late at night in the 1 and 2 a.m. in the mornings?
Not most of it, but on a good night, we will start recording at like 12:30. Bad night, we'll start recording at 2.
Man,
a bad night is usually we do a show Wednesday night, and that's his deadline for the Observer.
Sure.
And so invariably on Tuesday, like, something happens, and so Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever, and so, you know, he doesn't get done writing until 11:30. Then he's got a proofread, and I always text him about midnight, and I go, how's it going? And I'll usually get my answer about whether it's going to be a good or bad night right then. And you know, on a good Wednesday, we'll start at about 1 or 1:15 a.m. On a bad Tuesday, you're talking 2 or 2:15. Brutal.
Yeah.
No joke, man.
And then invariably, I upload it like at 3 o'clock in the morning. And like, I screw something up. And then the next morning, I have to hear all these people yelling at me that I made some mistake. It's like, dude, I uploaded this thing at 3 in the morning. I'm doing my best.
Right.
Yeah. No joke,
man. I can relate to that, actually, because that's my job.
I was going to say, Impact, you probably know a thing or two about that.
Yeah. Yeah. But we do what we can, right?
Most definitely, man.
You gotta do the best you can.
Yeah, definitely. So one thing that's really just kind of a stark contrast right now is the new kind of TMZ style for a lot of wrestling sites that will just report things right off the cuff, as opposed to things that I've seen on the Observer site where you wait to get the full details and then post the story. Do you have any type of thoughts about those other kind of news sites?
I mean, the only thing that really bothers me is if I say something on Observer Live that's clearly not news, like I'm speculating or I'm trying to figure out where WWE might, which I've given up on trying to figure out where WWE might be going, but I used to try.
Yeah, we all have.
And then I would invariably have people send me this news site, like writing an article saying that I had reported something that I never reported.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what bothers me. I mean, you know, I don't know about Dave. I think Dave, you know, to a degree he would like to be first. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's always sort of like I'd rather be second and get it right than mm-hmm. rush to be first and screw something up. That's always the way I've seen it. I don't think I don't feel like our subscribers are necessarily paying just like to get the news as quickly as possible.
Right.
Because you could just go on your Twitter timeline. You're going to get some news pretty quick there. But the Observer, I mean, the radio shows to me, I mean, the newsletter is more about, well, here's the news, and here it is in context. Here's what it means. Here's what we think it means based on doing this for X number of years, whatever. It's analyzing it. Yeah. And the same thing really with the audio shows. I mean, you know, sometimes there's breaking news on the audio shows, but mostly it's here's the news of the day. Here's what we think about it. Here may be some details that you haven't heard. This is what we think it means, and this is where we think it's going. And I think that that's more what people want rather than, hey, here's a 5-minute podcast. Here's every story that we are going to break as quickly as possible, half of which will be right, half of which will be wrong, and we're going to move on to something else.
Definitely, man. And, you know, you had mentioned Twitter. I'm curious as to your thoughts if the internet and Twitter and things like that have killed a lot of the mystique and a lot of the things that really made professional wrestling what it was.
I think to a degree social media has done that. I mean, I just know, and listen, I'm 44, I'm an old man, but when I was young, like the wrestlers were like these big superstars.
Yeah.
And I mean, you couldn't even imagine Bret Hart at the grocery store.
Yeah.
It's like, Bret Hart goes to the grocery store? Like, he shops for carrots? It doesn't even make sense in your brain.
Right.
Like, this guy's a big-time major superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And now, with social media, it's like, I look at some of these Twitter accounts, and I just think, this person is a geek. Like, why did they put this on Twitter? Why did they reveal this to the world? Like, mm-hmm. this is just any other dork with a Twitter account. And I think that, like, I mean, obviously, social media, I don't know. I'm maybe I'm an old man, but I feel like there should be some sort of mystique to the superstars, not just going out there and being just like everybody else with a Twitter account and tweeting stupid things and, you know, revealing themselves to have all of these weird issues. And I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a fan of the way that a lot of people use social. Some people use it very well.
Yeah.
But other people, I mean, if their lives would be much better and they would be bigger stars if they didn't have social media.
So speaking of social media and big stars, what do you think of Meltzer getting into Twitter wars with fans?
Well, I mean, I don't do it. So I guess that tells you what I think. I don't think that he should do it. I mean, here's part of it too. Like when we go to Q&As, someone invariably asks, Dave, why do you do this? And if he does the poll, like 50% of the people will raise their hand saying, will you stop doing this on Twitter? And then the other 50% will raise their hand saying, keep doing this. We think it's awesome. So the key is it's like a 50-50 thing, and he seems to really enjoy doing it. I think he takes a little bit of glee in it. He thinks that he is educating people by answering these people. I mean, to me, I wouldn't waste my... I got way more important things to do in my life than argue with people on Twitter.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, some of the people he argues with have two followers. So, like, you know
right.
that he blocked somebody,
yeah.
and they started a new egg account, and they're just doing it again. Mm-hmm. And so, like, to me, if you're going to do it, if this person has less than, like, 500 followers, like, you don't even acknowledge them at all, no matter how smart or stupid they appear to be, because they're not a real person. More than 500, you could consider it. But even then, it's like, why bother? Just, you know, there's, I don't know. Not my thing.
Well, do you think, in some ways... And this has kind of fascinated me in the perception of Dave. Do you think in some ways he almost perceptuates the heel aspect of things where, you know, he's been at this so long and there's so much, you know, when you hear, you know, guys like Bischoff or Pritchard and they do their shows and they, you know, will brag on Dave and whatnot. It almost seems like he's just kind of embraced that where he can be the black hat and just kind of go with it every once in a while and almost, you know, gets a kick out of, you know, playing that role that, you know, can engage in these Twitter wars and, you know, have a little bit more fun with it instead of just have people shit on him all over, you know.
Yeah, but I think that he obviously feels that he is the white hat.
Right.
And he is defending himself against the other black hat. And the other thing too, especially that newer fans need to realize is when you get mad at Dave for going after people on Twitter and that sort of thing, what you really need to do is get a bunch of back issues of the Observer from the 80s. I mean, Dave was brutal in those newsletters. He would just brutalize the wrestlers. He would make up names for them. This is just the 2019 version of
right.
something that he's done for his entire life.
Right.
I mean, if you say something stupid, he's going to correct you, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, you know, I mean, even when we were growing up, you know, Dave was at it, and it's kind of cool to see it's going to sound old and bad, but the grandfather of this type of, you know, journalistic reporting, still having, you know, his say in this world. You know, it's amazing that it's stuck around so long, that he's been able to continue it. And that says a lot about, you know, whether you like him or you hate him, you're still talking about him.
Well, what's funny is if you go online, especially like on Twitter or whatever, I mean, if you go online, you will get the impression that, like, everybody hates The Observer, Dave Meltzer, me, whoever. But the funny thing is, like, Dave and I have been going to shows together forever. And we really started going to shows a lot in 2006. We go to all of the big UFC events. And we go to wrestling shows here and there. And, I mean, from 2006 to today, I mean, if we go to an event together in 2019, I mean, he can't go 5 feet without absolutely being mobbed by people. And they want to take pictures with him. They want to sign. I mean, he literally, if you go to, like, a StarCast event or, you know, when we go to WrestleMania weekend and we go to, like, the big indie shows there, I mean, he can't go 5 feet. And never, actually, I will take that back. There's been one time, but only one time. Other than this one time, never you run into a fan that's just like a total jerk. I mean, everybody is so nice and they're so friendly. And then you go online and it's the total opposite. So I always try to tell people that, you know, the online world is not the real world.
Right. Right.
Obviously there are real human beings that are typing this stuff, but it's not the real world. Like what you see on the internet is not the real world. You go out in the real world and you see people for who they really are. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of, and it's not so much Dave, because Dave understands. I mean, he totally understands now.
Right.
But there are a lot of people on the internet that they live so deeply in the social media world that they think that that's the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
Yeah, definitely. And so obviously you mentioned StarCast and, you know, you mentioned WrestleMania weekend. Something that that Figure Four Weekly and the Observer does every single year is a yearly convention. So I've got to know who came up with that idea, and what did the early stages of that look like?
Well, believe it or not, Ed in San Antonio did in fact create the convention.
Hmm.
And I believe the first one was 2006, and I'm sure I have the number wrong, but it's close. We had like six people there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just all went to Vegas, six of us, and got plastered and paid to rescue Ed from a strip club after he ran up like a $1,200 bill with no money and took pictures of him outside the club with a traffic cone on his head. And that was like year one. And every year it got a little bigger. And now I don't want to say it's so big that it's split,
mm-hmm.
but this year, I mean, we used to always do SummerSlam weekend.
Right.
And this year we decided to do Memorial Day weekend because AEW is doing the big show.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we moved the convention to May, but like, I don't know about half, but like a good number of people that normally go every year, they're still going, but they're going in August because they couldn't go in May. So it sort of has split. But it's significantly bigger now. It's less a convention and more a chance for fans of the site to like go to Vegas and get together. Like there's no admission charge. There's no, I guess there are a few different events. Like Ed ran a wrestling show and there was a viewing of AEW, but it's not like, you know, StarCast where, you know, you buy tickets and you buy, it's just sort of like, this is when we're all going to be there. This is what you're going to do. If you want to come, get a plane ticket, get a hotel, and come have fun with us. And that's what it is.
Very cool.
So, speaking of Las Vegas and going back to your wrestling career, what was it like almost a year ago when you got back in the ring here at FSW and your pal Disco Inferno there came out to help you, but apparently it didn't go over that well, and he turned on you.
He did turn on me. I'm trying to remember the whole circumstance of that situation, but I think it was supposed to be me and Filthy Tom, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
Filthy got really angry at Ed because Ed made it public that he hadn't paid him the year before.
Oh, shit.
And so Tom was like, I'm not doing your show, dude. You're going to kill my bookings. You're an idiot. And so I ended up, we did an angle in the room with Disco. Like I said, I needed a partner, and I kept pretending like I was calling Disco, and he would never answer. And, you know, it was just like a stupid storyline where you knew if you were going to get a ticket that Disco was going to come out, even though I never said he was going to come out.
Right.
It was like patently obvious. And then we delivered on it. And, you know, we had the deal where he did a big babyface comeback. And he's a heel there.
Mm-hmm,
but,
right.
like, it was set up well enough that when he did his babyface comeback, like, everybody went crazy for him. And then he gave me a stunner and left, and that was it. We never really followed up on it. In fact, the promoter, when we went out for the show this year, was like, why haven't we done a promo but Disco yet? It's a decade-long deal here, buddy. We're taking our time. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Well, that's cool. I mean, you know, that's one of the nice things is that you can – you know, revisit it every once in a while. You don't have to put yourself under pressure of doing it night in, night out. It, you know, saves your sanity and saves your health, which is a great thing. And plus you get to, you know, every once in a while, your wife lets you be part of the boys, which is always a fun thing. So.
Well, it's fun too, to try to set up storylines on Observer Live. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm basically booking because, you know, I've had matches. Like, there was WrestleMania weekend this year was supposed to be me and Filthy against PCO and Marco Stunt. Mm-hmm. And, like, for 50 reasons, that match fell apart because, you know, people got signed different places and right. things fell through and people broke legs. And, yep. you know, we had to try and figure out, well, how do we make this work? And then I still want to do the Marco Stunt match. So I ended up just, like, booking a year-long storyline through Observer Live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people don't care. But, like, if you care, I mean, it was a pretty fun little deal. And people had fun with it, and it paid off in the end. And it was just fun to be able to, you know, practice sort of kind of booking your own stuff. It's not like booking a promotion or anything like that, but kind of getting people into the storylines and trying to make things make sense and have fun with it. So it's been fun.
Well, do you think, I mean, this is something that comes up a lot, and I think that, you know, anyone of our generation who watched wrestling when it only had the one pay-per-view, the two pay-per-views, the three pay-per-views, where everything was building up through like a Saturday night's main event. You didn't see the main stars on, you know, superstars and whatnot. Blue Moon, it would happen. Do you think that the longer storylines is kind of a lost art form? And I know the television is totally
Dude,
different.
Short storylines are a lost art form.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true.
I mean, if you are a WWE fan, I mean, this is a different era. I mean, you're not going to get a storyline that lasts to next week. Yeah. I mean, they're going to change everything. I mean, just on Monday, they announced a tag team title match. It this was at 3 p.m. It was a tag team match. By the time the show went on the air, it was a three-way. Like, there's no consistency to anything. Like, the Revival lose on Friday, they get a tag title shot on Monday. I mean, you can't even do a storyline over 3 days anymore.
Yeah.
But if you watch other promotions, like, you can watch New Japan, and they got storylines that, you know, the arc is years mm-hmm. long. So it absolutely can still be done, but if you're a WWE fan, I mean, it can't be done. It's just not going to be done until Vince is out of there and somebody else takes over. But you can watch NXT and see long story arcs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it absolutely is not a lost art. It can happen. It's just not going to happen on the WWE main roster.
Do you think some of that has to do with NXT's success, the fact that it is just a one-hour weekly program where you take that time, you know, you're not trying to score ratings or, you know, deal with commercial advertising, and then B, you don't have to push these guys every single week. You know, you could have 1 week, you know, your champ is on, and for two more weeks you might not see a certain, you know, a champion or a certain wrestler. Does that kind of build, I think, the fans' intrigue, and that's why the takeovers have such a special feel, or at least the fans are more receptive to them because it just feels like there's more of a payoff?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, number one, the 1 hour is a huge advantage over 3 hours. That's absolutely for sure. Number two, they tape 4 or 5 weeks in a row, or 4 or 5 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So even if, I mean, I don't think that Triple H is going to be a guy who's rewriting the show every Monday, but, you know, even if he was, he can't. You tape 5 weeks worth of shows.
Right.
They're in the can. Like, if you could figure out a way to tape 5 straight 3-hour Raws in a row, the show would immediately be better. Because they would have 5 weeks of consistency before they screwed it all up and then had another 5 weeks of consistency. So, being taped would be a huge advantage for Raw, and it's a huge advantage for NXT in that they're stuck in their storylines. And with takeovers, I mean, the thing with takeover is you build up 5 matches over 2 or 3 months or whatever, and that's it. It's 5 matches. It's your 5 best matches at any given time. It's not a 12-match show. It's not a show where you're trying to impress the people that buy WWE stock by telling them how many hours of product people are watching on the network. It's just a 2.5-hour show with 5 matches, and they let the guys go out there and have way more freedom than they do on the main roster, and you basically have all of the best guys from the indie scene out there having a super show every 3 months.
Right.
I mean, it's a completely different model from the main roster, and there are many reasons why it's more successful. At least, I should say more successful in terms of, you know, fan appreciation.
Right.
I mean, obviously, the main roster makes significantly more money for a lot of reasons.
Right. Do you think AEW has I mean, obviously, you know, we only get bits and pieces right now as they're, you know, coming up with the full plan. But do you think they have the ability to... We see the fervor. We see, I mean, the building was a buzz at Double or Nothing. It was crazy. Can they sustain it once it's a weekly television show? Or will there be that disillusionment that fans tend to have where all of a sudden they start picking this, picking that, and then they start shitting on the product?
Well, it's going to be very hard. I mean, the Double or Nothing show, I mean, they were running around like a chicken with their heads cut off. And that was one show.
Yeah.
And they even have admitted it. It's like, dude, this is going to be hard. I mean, we're going to be doing weekly. We're going to have to do this every single week. And it's going to be very, very difficult. I mean, the good news is it's a bunch of really smart people. I mean, Tony Khan has been an Observer subscriber forever. He's a huge fan of old school, simple, basic pro wrestling. I mean, he's not going to be doing the death of WCW here.
Right.
They're on a very strong network. I mean, TNT is in more homes than USA.
Right.
I mean, right off the bat, they're at a slight advantage over WWE. I mean, they're not the name brand or anything like that, but they have a talent budget. They have all of their production paid for, plus they're getting a cut of advertising revenue. I mean, if they don't do anything stupid, I mean, the company is probably going to be profitable in just a couple of years. And I mean, 100,000 buys for that pay-per-view. I mean, it is going to be very, very difficult for them to do weekly television, something they've never done before.
Right.
But if they can do it, I mean, it should be a very, very viable number two. I mean, it's not going to be beating WWE in revenue like maybe ever because of the WWE stock price and everything else.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, as far as like a show that could potentially beat SmackDown, if SmackDown moves to FS1, it could beat the third hour of Raw. For all I know, it could even beat Raw. I don't know. It's absolutely not out of the question. So, especially with the Raw numbers that we see today. But yes, that first, I mean, going on television live every week is going to be a big challenge.
So, obviously, you know, Dave is known for his star rating scale. And you have become synonymous with your minus star scale. This is just an interesting kind of question here. Of all of the matches that you've given minus 5 stars to, which match would you say is probably the worst?
Oh, God. I love how it's become synonymous with minus 5 stars.
Dude, you have a shirt.
One... Well, yeah. Which actually is the best-selling shirt in the entire store, believe it.
So, I can believe it.
I mean, it probably would have to be like the Charmel Jenna Maraska match, which is what spawned that shirt. I mean, I could probably find one worse, mm-hmm. but it would be hard. There's a lot of minus 5-star matches from, you know, the 80s and 90s. Like the Hogan Warrior match was minus 5 stars. The War Games where Warrior disappeared in smoke was minus 5 stars. But I've rewatched those matches, and like they're horrible. But I mean, compared to some of the stuff that we've seen in Impact, and some of the stuff we've seen with like people who have no business being in the ring, like celebrities and that sort of thing, yeah. Those matches aren't that bad.
Right.
I mean, they're horrible. Don't get me wrong. But a minus 5-star match from the 90s ages much better. Because of some of the horrible stuff that we saw like in TNA with Charmel and Jenna Maraska. So yeah. That would be way up there. And the Bushwhackers versus the Yanchik and Nikolai Volkov. But I'd have to go back and watch that one again.
Right, so, yeah. So you mentioned...
That was the original worst match I'd ever seen.
Yeah, that one's terrible. Obviously, you know, you mentioned, you know, that era of Impact. And you are, for better or worse, a WCW historian. So I've got to know which era would be the worst out of those. Would it be the Impact of that era, or would it be the end of WCW?
Well, my friend, when I was watching Impact as it happened, I was a decade removed from WCW, and when I watched those Impact shows, I was like, dude, this is the worst I've ever seen. And Dave would always say, no, nothing was worse than the end of WCW. And I said, no, you're wrong. This is the worst I've ever seen. So now I have gone back, and I'm in the middle of Russo's second run in WCW.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have not watched the worst of Impact now in 10 years. So as I watch this, I'm sure that there's nothing worse than the end of WCW. Now, maybe someday I'll watch that Impact stuff again and change my mind. Literally, they're like neck and neck.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, WCW at one point was successful and then it failed.
Mm-hmm.
And Impact was like never successful. It just perpetually failed. So you can sort of like pick your poison, like which was worse, a company that like never got good despite like having all sorts of resources, or a promotion that had all these resources and like killed itself. Well, I think I got to go with WCW, but Impact was pretty bad.
Yeah.
What's interesting, and I mean, really, I hate to do it, but it, you know, it comes down to the thread of this all is Russo.
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
you know what? I'm actually going to say something nice about Vince Russo, okay? Vince Russo was a tremendous heel character on television.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He was great.
Yeah.
I cannot lie about this. I'm watching him as a heel, and I'm like, this dude is great. But he had no concept of what made pro wrestling work.
Yep.
And he wrote the worst shows I've ever seen, and it continued through from WCW through to Impact Wrestling.
Yeah.
Just absolutely mind-bogglingly. And you know what? I was just watching an Impact where he beat Ric Flair and they shaved his head and they shaved his son's head and his family was at ringside. And it was a disaster because they didn't even bill it as a hair match. They didn't even say at the beginning of the show the hair's on the line. They just like did it. And I watched it and I thought, you know what? If somebody with a brain had sat down with Vince Russo and Vince Russo had given them this exact idea, this would have been like an all-time legendary angle. It could have been built up and set up and delivered and it would have been a legendary angle.
Yeah.
But because he had no concept of how to do pro wrestling, they took what could have been a legendary angle and they threw it all away on a Nitro that did a terrible number.
Yep.
So he was at his best when he was with Vince McMahon, back when Vince knew what he was doing, and Russo could come up with these ideas, and Vince and Cornette and Jim Ross could take the idea and turn it into something great.
Yeah.
And that was a perfect little group of people putting together television. When he went off on his own, it was a disaster. And it was a disaster in every promotion that he went to where he went off on his own.
Yeah, which is amazing when you talk about someone who definitely has the ability to sell himself. That's the number one thing that I take away from Vince Russo, is that regardless if you like him or you hate him, you have to give him credit for being able to get those jobs. And people still take a chance on him, even seeing the track record. And just, you know, he's just that.
Well, he is, but you also have to consider, like, when he jumped from WWF to WCW, I mean, it was easy to convince people that he was responsible because he was one of the main guys on the writing crew, and they were in a very successful period, and WCW was sinking. And so that was an easy sell. Like, dude, me and Ferraro were the right-hand people with Vince McMahon, and look at this company and look at your company. They're like, dude, please come aboard.
but
after his second run, like, there's no logical reason that anybody should have hired him.
Well, it's very interesting though, like, because I find that right there, you said the key word, second run. He got a fucking second run.
Yes.
You know, it's like, wait, you knew your product, you knew what was going on with him, and then you gave him the run again? What's going on?
Yes. they gave him a second run, and then he ended up working for TNA like forever. And you know, a large part of it was Dixie Carter didn't know anything about wrestling.
Yeah.
And when you don't know anything about wrestling, then this guy, you know, he convinced her based on his WWF run, and he snowed her with numbers regarding his WCW run, which were he bamboozled her with those numbers. And so, you know, the most amazing thing to me about it is, you know, he worked there for a long time, and they did not turn things around.
Yeah.
And they did not bring themselves up to a better level, and she kept him around.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why they lost their deal on Spike TV. I mean, lying about Vince Russo, when they found out that she'd been lying, that was the end.
That was it, yep.
So, I mean, that's two companies that he basically sunk.
Right.
Without a doubt, man. All right, so Brian, as we're kind of winding things down a little bit here, we've got a little segment that we like to do here on the show, and it's just a simple word association. So I'm going to say a name or a promotion, something along that line, and what I'd like for you to do is just to tell me the very first thing that pops into your head when I say it, and we're going to do this for 70 seconds. So this is 70 deadly seconds. Are you ready, sir?
Oh, God. Is there a prize at the end?
we might be able to find something from the vault for you.
All right, let's see what we got.
All right, cool. So first things first, Buddy Wayne.
Awesome.
Dave Meltzer.
Incredible.
Filthy Tom Lawler.
Sensitive.
Aww. Baron Corbin.
He is a very sensitive man. You wouldn't believe it.
Baron Corbin.
He's the only man I've ever got to cry on the show. Baron Corbin, horrible.
Baron Corbin.
Horrible.
Lance Storm.
Extremely intelligent.
Marco Stunt.
Very short.
Vince Russo.
An idiot.
Jack Evans.
Very talented.
Black Label Pro.
A lot of fun.
The Rock and Roll Express.
Incredible. I would say incredible about a lot of people, but they were incredible.
Definitely. And last but not least, the best in the world, Shane McMahon.
Purple.
Awesome.
Really quick, let's talk a little bit about Jack Evans. It's taken him a while, but he's, you know, been someone who's been able to continue his process and learn and grow, and, you know, is definitely getting that shot now with AEW. Did you see in him back when he was starting out that it factor? That he would, or was he someone that you knew he had the passion but was going to have to work on it?
Well, every now and then there's a video that pops up on social media of this Evening Magazine video from like 1999 or 2000 or something like that, and it's a little story on Jack Evans. And in the video, there is a very fat Brian Alvarez yelling at him about trying to convince him not to kill himself or giving him whatever. So when I first met him, like, he could do anything athletic in the ring. Like, he could do 450s, shooting star press, he could do anything. But he was constantly taking bumps in his neck, landing on his head, didn't know how to put a match together, just all high spots. And so, you know, I wanted to work with him because he was my size.
Yeah.
And so we started doing matches together, and my entire goal was I want to help him have good matches and not kill himself. And, you know, later he always said that I was his trainer. And for a long time, I would not take credit for training him. And it actually made him feel bad, and I'm sad about that. I didn't not take credit for training him because I was embarrassed or anything like that. To me, I was just a guy that was in there helping him try try to have his matches get a little bit better.
Yeah.
Which is the role of the more experienced wrestler. Like, to me, you know, Tim Flowers trained him, or whatever schools that he went to.
Right.
And, you know, years later I talked to him and he goes, dude, I went to Tim Flowers school. He didn't teach me anything. He sat there, yelled at me, you know, he wasn't my trainer. Like, you, I consider my trainer because you're the one that actually helped me learn how to do this. And so I was, you know, I'm happy that he says that. You know, I never really considered myself like his trainer. I was just someone that helped him do magic. And I knew that he had a ton of potential. I knew that if he could figure out how to put a match together, he could be something. But you also have to remember that this was like the late 90s, and guys our size,
right.
I mean, maybe you could be in the WCW Cruiserweight division and get buried.
Yeah.
But like, guys our size never went on to become stars. And, you know, I would always say, you know, maybe you should go to Mexico. Because that's what Buddy Wayne would have said. Like, if you were small and you were good, he was like, go to Mexico. Like, maybe you can do something in Mexico. We can have a hard time in this country. And the other thing was, nobody from the Northwest ever went anywhere.
Right.
Like, everybody hears about Brian Kendrick and Brian Danielson.
Yeah.
But, like, they never worked here. They started by flying to Shawn Michaels school.
Right.
Because there was nothing in the Northwest, and nobody here ever made it anywhere. So it wasn't like I never thought he could make it. It was just that I thought, you know, this is going to be hard, because it's hard for anybody. Like, if you want to be something, you got to get out of the Pacific Northwest. You got to go somewhere else, and you got to train somewhere else, and you got to take matches somewhere else. And I was very happy when he went places and made a name for himself. And, you know, now he's in AEW, and he's had a great career, and he's worked in Ring of Honor and Impact in Mexico. And I watched his match at the AEW show, and I thought he was the best guy in the whole match. He was awesome in that match.
Yeah,
he's a really great wrestler. So, yeah, I'm very proud of him. But even today, it's still weird to have him say that I'm his trainer, because I always looked at his trainer as something else.
Well, you know what? That's a credit to you. And, you know, I think that as we get older, you know, you look at people as peers, but sometimes it's that mentorship that you really never even thought that you were really doing. That
I never thought that I was doing that.
And that's the coolest thing. It's like, you know, again, I think a lot of people don't know, you know, sometimes, you know, whether it's they listen to the podcast or, you know, you work with someone in a ring or, you know, even at your 9-to-5 job, you know, there just might be someone that you talk to that has an impact on your life that you never think that you're doing something to impact that person. And I think that that's a great example of, you know, here's something you didn't even think you were doing. And it's wonderful that he, you know, looked at you as that. And I think that, you know, as you can be proud of it. And know that, you know, at least something that you did while you were in the ring helped someone else, you know, try to and come, you know, forward and hitting their dreams and going on with their goals, which I think is something that a lot of people, you know, maybe don't even realize they ever did in life. And that's pretty, you know, an excellent accomplishment without knowing that you did that.
Well, I also, like, I always would prefer to wrestle somebody who is not as experienced as I am, because, you know, what I learned in wrestling was all from Buddy Wayne.
Yeah.
I was like a Jack Evans, and Buddy Wayne took me under his wing, and he took me to all of these shows, and he carried me through all of these matches, and he taught me, I mean, most everything that I know as a wrestler that is any good.
Yeah.
And so I always wanted to do the same thing for other people. I mean, you know, it would be preposterous for Jungle Boy to come out and do an interview and say, Brian Alvarez is my trainer. But, like, when I heard that they were going to offer me a match with Jungle Boy, and they said, well, you know, he's green, but he's got a lot of potential, it was like, I would love to do this.
Yeah.
You know, and by the time we did the match, like, he was great. So
yeah.
He was not the green guy that they were telling me about, you know, 6-8 months earlier. He'd improved a ton. But that was another match where, you know, I watched his matches, and it was lots of high spot, move, 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 move. And I can't do a match like that. That's not my match. My match is, let's work a match where nobody gets hurt,
yeah,
and we tell a story, I mean, I sound like an old guy, but this is my view of wrestling. We don't get hurt. We tell a story. We work hard. We don't go in there and be lazy. We work our asses off. But nobody gets hurt, and the people get into it, and they like it, and there's a satisfying conclusion, and everybody goes home happy. And that's what I wanted to do with him, and that's what I did, and I felt very happy with it, and he was happy with it, and the promoter was happy with it, and that's what I love about wrestling.
Yeah.
I would much rather do that than you know, I'd love to have a match with Okada or whatever, but, you know, I'd rather go in there and help somebody out, and I don't know, that's just my view of wrestling. I'm more comfortable doing that than just going in there and trying to have, like, a blow-away five-star match.
And, you know, you mentioned something right there in passing, helping people. I think that, you know, it one thing that isn't really portrayed enough is, you know, the things that you do outside of the ring and in terms of teaching people. And I know that you're involved with Whale Scout, a nonprofit. If you could do me a favor and just shine a light on that really quickly, as far as maybe some of our listeners aren't aware of what that is.
Well, my wife runs it, and it is a nonprofit that she started. She's always loved whales, and she wanted to do something. She went to college, 2 degrees, but, you know, job market, it's tough. And so several years ago, I mean, her whole thing was, what if I started my own nonprofit? I mean, I could do something for the whales. And it started out as sort of like, it started out as you know, a group that would go and they would go to beaches with binoculars when the whales are out, and they would show people the whales, and, you know, people who have never seen whales before, like, they're blown away. And then you tell them, you know, there's 76 of these left. They're critically endangered, and they want to know what they can do. And then you give them some household tips or whatever, and blah, blah, blah. And that morphed into her realizing that, you know, the real problem with the whales is they don't have enough to eat. Salmon runs in the Northwest are at 10% of what they were like 100 years ago. 10%.
Wow.
So there's no fish out there. And so she realized that, you know, it's fun to go and watch whales and everything like that, but what really needs to be done is habitat needs to be restored. And so that's what Whale Scout became. They show people the whales, but then they direct them towards their, 12 to 14 helping out events they do every year, where they go and they restore habitats. They restore streams, parks, et cetera, to try to open up these waterways so that the salmon can thrive and feed whales and feed people too. So that's the whole idea behind Whale Scout, and it's grown. I mean, she's always wanting it to be more, and she gets discouraged here and there, but I always tell her, like, you don't even realize how big this is, like, compared to what I do. I mean, this is real life big stuff.
Right.
Right.
And you've been doing it 5 years, and I've been doing this for like 25 years. So you're so far beyond where I was 5 years in. This is like a really big, cool deal. And yeah, whalescout.org. She does a podcast, all sorts of cool things. So you can check it out there.
Awesome. Brian, we just want to, as we wrap up here, let everyone know that you have, again, your book is coming out July 16th called 100 Things WWE Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And they can get that at Amazon and all those other book places that you can download them from. Also, you can continue to hear your weekly podcast off the Wrestler Observer Figure 4 as well. So we thank
Daily.
Daily.
Oh, daily.
Yeah.
My bad. Daily.
Not only is it daily, I have days where I do 3 a day. So
oh, three?
I'm doing about 15 podcasts a week. So if you want to hear more, that's the place to go.
Boy, we got a lot to catch up with, guys. I can barely get through one, and he's got three. That's awesome.
Somebody did a count the other day in our archives at WrestlingObserver.com.
Uh-huh.
We have 10,300 podcasts.
Jesus.
And I think I've been on 95% of those.
Wow.
That's awesome. Well, you can, for folks that already don't know, and we already know they do, you can go to F4WOnline.com and get all that information. And that's pretty much it, man. Anything else you want to promote or your social media info?
Now you can go to @BrianAlvarez on Twitter. The main thing, obviously, is FRWOnline.com or WrestlingObserver.com. They both go to the same place. Mm-hmm. All of our social media is there, links to all the shows, newsletters. There's news there every day. There's all sorts of great stuff. So check it out.
No doubt. Everyone, Brian Alvarez.
Woo! Hey, thank you.
Now the studio audience can finally go home.
Yeah. They've been here all day.